start with a story. In 1980, I went to the States to start one of our centres in Boston, Massachusetts. And when I first got there, I went round to a number of different Buddhist centres just to see what was going on, to see what the scene was. And one day I went along to a Zen centre, and at the end of a period of just sitting meditation, and everyone was very quiet. But eventually someone sort of rather tentatively piped up and said, I have a question. What is meditation? And the teacher there looked at him and said, who are you? And everybody thought there was a kind of tension in the air. And the chap said, John. Everybody laughed. Thought it was really funny. Who are you? He said, I'm John Key from Somerville. Everybody laughed some more. And then he said, who are you? I'm John, I'm at MIT, I'm studying programming. And everybody laughed some more. Anyway, this went on a few more times, and in the end, poor old John was asked one more time, who are you? He says, I don't know. Good, go there, don't know. Mm-hmm. Now, I thought, well, if that guy's read a little bit about Zen, he probably thinks he's met a Zen master and he's had some kind of sort of initiation. If not, then he's just been totally confused and he's got no idea what Buddhism's all about. He asked a perfectly sensible question, what is meditation? And he gets a very, very sort of almost aggressive kind of response that made him feel a bit silly. However, that question is a really important one. Who are we? Who are you? That is a really crucial question. It's perhaps one of the most important questions that's ever been asked. It's a question that anybody who thinks a little bit for themselves is going to ask at some time. Who am I? What am I here for? Where do I come from? What am I meant to do? Okay, you could say, well, I'm Manjivadra, I'm from Salford, you know, I do this, I do that, I'll do the other. But that's not really the point of the question, is it? The question goes much deeper than that. Who is this self? Who is this me? There's definitely a me. I know me. I've known me all my life. I can't get rid of me. Sometimes I just like to get rid of me, but I can't. I stay there. Sometimes I want to hold on to things that are me or mine, and I can't do that either. It's a very elusive item, this me. It's a very, very, very difficult thing to get hold of, but it's so central to our lives. In fact, it's right at the core of our lives. It's right at the very centre of our lives, but we don't really know much about it. So this evening, I want to just reflect on this question a little bit. We could take a simple answer. We could say, well, me, this body, this is who I am. When I die, that's it, all gone. That is a perfectly reasonable perspective, but it doesn't seem to hold much weight. People don't really kind of like that view. They don't really believe it. On the other hand, you might think, well, I have something deep inside with me that is really, really, really me, my soul, it's there. It's sort of, it's more than my body, it's more permanent than my body. My body might fall apart, but my soul will continue in some way or another. Either it'll go to heaven or the other place, or it'll just return to this life for another existence. Well, the Buddha rejected both of these views. He didn't accept that at the end of life, when the body decays, that's it. On the other hand, he also didn't accept the view that there's anything from this life that goes on to the next. So this is quite a mystery, isn't it? This is a real mystery. The Buddha taught rebirth. Rebirth, we're told, is not reincarnation, and it's not nihilism. But you know, I've never actually been told what rebirth actually is. It's very difficult to get anybody to commit themselves to saying what rebirth is. All they'll say is, it's not reincarnation. Rebirth isn't a doctrine of something within me that goes on to another life or above or below. Neither is rebirth to do with nihilism. You know, that when you're dead, you're gone, finished, that's it. There's no repercussions from your life whatsoever in any dimension. Now, I've puzzled over this for years, donkey's years. And I've come up with a little solution that satisfies me. I think that rebirth, well, death is a mystery. It's an ultimate mystery. We know that I exist here, but what happens after death? The fact is, we just don't know. We don't know what happens after death. And I think the Buddha was interested in maintaining that mystery. So he said, it's neither the extreme of continued existence, nor is it the extreme of no existence. It's a mystery. It's just a mystery. So rebirth, in a way, is another word, I think, for mystery. It's a mystery. We don't know what's going to happen in the future. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. Tomorrow's a mystery. So beyond our sort of bodily existence is also a mystery. We just don't know what's going on. And I think living with that mystery is what the Buddha was getting at. He was trying to encourage us to live without coming to any conclusions about what happens beyond this life. However, he did say something. What he said was that all things arise in dependence upon conditions. When those conditions cease, the thing ceases. And that applies to absolutely everything in existence. And this is something that one has to reflect on again and again and again. It applies to absolutely everything. There is nothing which is eternally existent. There's nothing which has an existence, a self-contained existence. So we immediately dismiss God. We immediately dismiss any permanently existing soul. We dismiss Brahma, and so on. Everything arises in dependence upon conditions. When you really think about it, it's a pretty scary thing. It's quite mysterious. Because we, each of us, has arisen from conditions. The miracle that is each of us has come out of conditions. Let's just have a look at where we come from. So we're going to answer this question, who am I, or at least where do I come from? And then later on I hope to go into the whole question of, well, who am I? Why am I like I am? So we go back 13.6 billion years, when there was a vast amount of energy, no space and no time. And then if we're to believe what the physicists say, up comes the Higgs boson, and we're away. We've got something material. Out of something material comes various elementary particles, quarks, mesons, protons. Eventually, after some tens of nanoseconds, I think it was, there's a few protons around. Those protons begin to develop. So out of this energy evolves the protons. To cut a long story short, out of the protons evolves suns. Out of the suns evolves all the other elements that we have in the universe. Out of those elements evolve planets. Out of those planets evolve all sorts of material stuff, earth, all the rocks, all the chemicals, all the inert substance of this earth arose. It only took, I can't remember exactly, about, does anyone know? 10, 12 billion years, something like that. A slow evolution, the evolution to the point of the existence of our planet. That was pretty miraculous. But then something even more miraculous happened. Some of those chemicals and things, those elements that were created, started to combine with each other. They started the sodium saw the chlorine and said, hey, let's get together. And they got together and formed good old salt. And so we got all of these various chemicals producing each other, but they were still inert. They didn't do anything. The miracle was that there were then some molecules which developed, apparently inside comets out in space, in the water inside comets. And these chemicals had the remarkable ability that they could split themselves into two copies of themselves. At first, these chemicals were comparatively very simple. But the chemical compound would form, it would split into two molecules of the same compound, which would then split into two. So we had the beginnings of something that was actually living. It wasn't inert. It was actually creating itself. Out of these chemicals, there were more complex molecules. Out of these more complex molecules, there were cells. The cells produced themselves. Out of these cells, there were more complex organisms. Out of these more complex organisms, we got things like, eventually, we got plants. Whole planet covered in plants. All sorts of plants. Big ones, little ones. All sort of growing. Just growing all over the place. Some of these things that grew had a sort of sensitivity. A sensitivity to light, let's say, or heat. They would move towards light or heat. You could say that in a very crude way, they were beginning to be conscious of light and heat and moving towards it. As you know, as you see with any plant, it grows, it moves towards the light. It senses where the light is. It's conscious of how to go to the light. So we're seeing a very, very crude form of sense consciousness developing out of those living organisms. That consciousness, or the beings, the living beings that have that kind of consciousness, get more and more complex. Remarkable things like eyes and ears, and the ability to sense, taste, these things start to gradually develop out of what went before into more and more complex, more and more sense-aware beings. We've got another whole level of existence here. And then, out of these increasingly complex organisms, these animals, we get a new kind of animal, an animal which is a kind of beginning of a human being. And another remarkable thing happens. Not only is that animal conscious through the senses of things around them, they're actually aware that they're conscious of those things. And this miracle of self-awareness comes into being. So in each of these stages, you see it's all been conditioned. We don't know what that very first condition was. It is said that it was the collapsing of another universe. This is exactly what Buddhist mythology tells us, but science is also beginning to tell us something similar. So from that point, we can observe the continuous evolution into, first of all, matter, which is what Buddhism calls the Ujjayi-nyama, and then into living beings, which Buddhism calls the Bijja-nyama, and then into simple sense consciousness, which is the Mano-nyama, and then into fully self-aware consciousness, which is the Karma-nyama. How does this self-consciousness really develop? We can see that we've come from the animals. We can see how we've grown up from all those different levels of conditionality to what we are. But let's just sort of imagine anyway how it could sort of develop. I don't know if you've ever watched a horse in the rain. I'm sure some of you have. You know, a horse sort of stands there in the rain with its head down, thinking it's cold and it's wet. It's cold and it's wet. It's cold and it's wet. But it doesn't do a lot about it. However, my dad's cat, when my dad's cat's out in the rain, he He says, it's cold and it's wet, I'm getting out of here. And immediately goes to the coal shed or under the hedge. Or, if I'm kind enough, opening the door, it comes into the house. So that cat has got some sort of awareness that it's cold and wet and it needs to go somewhere dry. But it's instinctive. I'm not so sure with the cat, but mainly it's instinctive. It's a kind of, it's a response to an unpleasant situation and then moving into something which is more pleasant. A tiger gets cold and wet and goes and finds a cave. If anybody else tries to come in that cave, the tiger sees them off. The tiger gets rid of them. So we're seeing here a little bit of a sense of kind of, me and mine. This is my cave. You do not belong in my cave. We can see the shift here from just a kind of a very sort of instinctive response to something which has got, seems to have something of a degree of sort of possessiveness in it. You can observe the same thing with mating. I watch the ducks on the river outside my boat, and once a drake has decided on a particular duck, then he'll chase off all the other drakes. He's aware that this is his, what's a female duck? His duck. And he'll chase the other drakes away. So you can see there's a beginnings. It's once we're aware of, once we're conscious of things in the world, we can begin to start to sort of see how people could identify with the things that they've got, like the cave or the mate. Often human beings function strictly on this level. And it must be said, sometimes you look around and it seems that some human beings don't really go an awful lot further beyond that. So instinctual possession eventually becomes self-conscious. There's a me and mine. I possess things. Once we've got this sort of sense of a self and sense of possession and a sense of me, then we start to think of myself as becoming more and more a real thing. It's as though I actually exist. I'm a me. I exist somewhere. And what happens then is we start to experience the world in a completely different way. One of the things I noticed about my dad's cat is if I have to tell it off or do something accidentally nasty to it, the cat growls at me and sort of scratches me and sort of, generally expresses his dislike. But 2 or 3 minutes later, he's fine. You know, he's sort of going to let me stroke him and there's no problem at all. However, once we've got a kind of self, once we've got a sense of self, we've got a memory of like, okay, that person hurt me. I'm going to get my own back, or I'm not going to go near them, or something like that. So we start to experience the world in a different way. We don't just take it as it comes in the immediate moment. We start to construct things. We start to construct a whole image of what the world is. Now, this is an incredibly powerful ability. It's a miraculous thing. And it's also an evolutionarily very powerful advantage. It gives those that have it an advantage over others because they can plan, they can organise, they can structure, they can imagine the world to be in a particular way. So self-consciousness is not to be sniffed at. Self-consciousness is a very important, a very crucial stage of the evolutionary process. However, as I'll describe later, it does actually trap us. We can get trapped at that level of evolution, forgetting that the self that we've constructed is in fact just a construction that we've made, can dominate us and mean that we only experience things in terms of me living in a particular world. Let's just reflect for a moment on what we've got at this very moment. At this moment, here and now, we are a manifestation of the whole evolutionary process, which really is quite miraculous to think of. We really are quite marvellous beings. Even with all our faults and peccadilloes, we're incredible beings. We've got stuff in our body. We've got chemicals. We've got the results of all of those billions of years of material evolution. We've got it here. We carry it around with us. We've got life. Our cells produce. We reproduce. We've got that sort of whole living dimension in us as well. We're a manifestation of that. We're a manifestation of sense consciousness. We've got eyes, ears, smells, tastes. We can touch things. We've got all of these wonderful awarenesses, all these wonderful consciousnesses. And also, we've got this self-consciousness. We've got a sense of self. We've got the ability to pull all those senses together, build a relationship with the world, develop ideas, develop thoughts, and so on. It's useful, I think, just to reflect on the value of this life that we have and not waste it. You know, it's a remarkable thing. It really, really shouldn't be wasted. So, what's the problem? What's the problem with self-consciousness? I mean, it's a pretty good thing. You've got to admit, it's pretty marvellous. So, what is the problem with self-consciousness? Well, first of all, there's me. We experience me. I'm aware of my wants, my needs, my likes and dislikes. And we experience those things as real, as real characteristics of a real person. We think of this as my body. It belongs to me. I possess it. It's mine. All these limbs and things, they're all mine. We think, I've got feelings. I like some things. I dislike other things. These are my feelings. They're not anybody else's. They're my feelings. They're important. They're my feelings. We've got our own perceptions, our own ideas of the world around us. For example, we have ideas about other people. We have stories that we tell ourselves about other people. You know, why they're nasty to us, why they're kind to us. You know, lots of good stories about them, a few bad stories about them perhaps. But we each have a kind of a perspective on each of the people that we know and all the people around us and all the world around us. All of these things we possess, these are mine. This is real. This is what is really mine. We have desires. Our desires we seem to particularly value. If a desire arises, it becomes really, really important. It must be followed. And we have our own understanding, our own consciousness of what the world really is. Now, all of these things we believe in. We believe in them very thoroughly, very fundamentally. However, the problem is, reality is not like that. Yeah? Reality does not conform to all of those characteristics, desires, wants, feelings, and so on. For example, if it's my body, how comes it gets old? You know, how come it sort of gets diseased? How come I ache more than I used to? How come I'm more tired than I used to be? You know, if it was mine, if I was in control of it, if I was designing it, it wouldn't be like this at all. It would be something completely different. But reality has got other ideas. My feelings cannot always be satisfied. My desires can certainly not always be satisfied. My perceptions of reality sometimes don't seem to work. They don't seem to kind of fit. And anyway, other people disagree with them. So we've got all of these things that we really believe in, that we really think, well, this is me, this is mine, this is what I am. But reality does not support that. Reality contradicts it. We take possession of things. You know, this is my boat. Well, if it's my boat, how come it rusts? How come I have to fix the engine? You know, although I want to possess things or I want to claim they're mine, I lose them. This is my lover, you know, lost, gone. How many times? We try to hold on, but we lose things. Sometimes there's an I which is really kind of very determined and aggressive, a kind of proud I. You know, I am. You know, I don't care what anybody says. I am. This is what I am. This is what I stand for. And that can become a very sort of very very powerful, very dominant sort of experience. Again, reality does not support it. Reality contradicts it. So the trouble is, although we have this sense of self, reality is continually impinging upon it and causing us dukkha. That's what dukkha is. Dukkha is the pain, the dissatisfaction of reality impinging upon my idea of me, mine, and who I am. This is what the Buddha really means by dukkha. It can be something exceedingly painful, physically painful. If you get very sick, for example, it can be emotionally painful if you lose somebody you love. But it can be not quite as painful as that. It can just be a slight sense of like things are just not right. You know, I don't feel fulfilled. I don't feel complete. There's something not right with the world or with me or something. Now that also is dukkha, and it arises because our expectations are not in line with how things really are. Now Buddhism is concerned with the elimination of dukkha, the elimination of the kind of suffering which is caused through this conflict between the self and reality. And in a way, that is the only thing that it's concerned with. In other words, the only thing that Buddhism is really concerned with is taking a self-conscious human being and encouraging them, showing the ways in which that self-conscious being can go beyond that self-consciousness. In other words, move to a new level of evolution. In the same way that sense consciousness through a miracle becomes self-consciousness. Self-consciousness through a miracle becomes transcendental consciousness. And this is what Buddhism is concerned with. It's concerned with purifying the self-consciousness that we have to such a degree that we can gain a glimpse of something which is beyond, a consciousness which is beyond a self-centered, self-cherishing consciousness. A glimpse that becomes so strong that we start to pursue it. And that becomes the drive in our lives. That's what we move towards. Now, Buddhism is only concerned with this. Buddhism, it's interesting, this is a slight aside actually. Buddhism has never taken an interest in the Ujjayi-nyāma, the Bijjayi-nyāma, or the Manoniyāma. In other words, it's never taken an interest in the physical world, the world of living beings, or in purely sense consciousness. Edward Conza, famous writer on Buddhism, wrote in Buddhist Thought in India, I think it was, that he felt this is why the Chinese never developed science, because the Chinese were a Buddhist culture, and they didn't take an interest in the world around them, understanding, penetrating the conditionality of the material niyama and the living niyama. So they never really developed science. Now things have shifted. we'll see what happens. They'll probably move on apace. But I think this is why I mention this and why I stress it, is I think sometimes we can look at Buddhist teaching as though it was science, as though it was a kind of a scientific theory, but it isn't. It's not meant to be scientific. It's all of the teachings, the doctrines, they're for reflection. They are supports to give us an insight into this next level of consciousness. They're not meant to be a kind of scientific analysis of what goes on around us. Now, I say this because I'm now going to have a look at what the Buddha described as the way that the self develops, to look at the 12 links of conditioned co-production. Have people heard of this before? Some indication? Yes? Nods? Nods? Questioning looks? We can refer to this image. Has people seen this one, this before? No? This is a Tibetan version of... well, actually, it's not. It's English. It was painted by an Englishman. But it's... or drawn by an Englishman and then painted by someone else. It shows our existence. These six big sections represent the different kind of worlds, the spectrum of the kind of worlds that we can live in. There's the hell realm, where everything's painful. There's the preta realm, the ghost realm, which is dominated by desire. So this is when a being is completely dominated by desire. They're like a ghost, just moving from one thing to another. Over there we have the animal realm. Animals are fine, they've got sense consciousness, but they're entirely dependent upon their environment. They get a good environment, they're happy. They get a bad environment, they experience pain. They have no control over it. Over there we have them, you can't see them very clearly, but they're all fighting. They're the titans. They're beings who are driven by desire for development, even achievement. But they fight other people for it. They're continually fighting, continually struggling. I guess a lot of them would be able to get jobs in the City of London these days. So that's the kind of psychology, at least. Right at the tops we have the gods, the angels. They don't do anything. They just live in continual bliss, continual happiness, for aeons and aeons. Lying on couches, drinking ambrosia, surrounded by beautiful people. You know, not a bad life, though limited, because it's still dominated by self-consciousness. And here we have the human beings doing all sorts of things, building things, reading, writing, monks teaching, all sorts of activities going on. The kind of healthy, ordinary human realm, not distorted in any way as the others are. In the centre we have the pig, the cock and the snake, which represent greed, hatred and delusion, which drive the whole wheel around. But what I'm really interested today, on the outside we have the demon of impermanence. The whole thing's impermanent, the whole thing's shifting and turning all the time. And he is holding it. What I'm interested in is the outer circle from here all the way around. There are 12 sections in that, and each of them represents a certain stage in the development of the self-consciousness. Now, I want to stress what I said just now. This is not meant to be a scientific exposition. Yeah? It's not even meant to be a philosophic exposition. It's just something to reflect on. It's just some ideas, some connected ideas, to enable us to reflect on, well, where do I come from? So we'll go through them briefly. In the meditation, we're also going to go through them again in a more meditative process. So we start with these two. These two are said to be the links of the past. These are to do with the past. First of all, we have a blind man, someone suffering from ignorance. They don't see the truth. In other words, they haven't seen that they don't actually have a self. They're blinded to the truth of things. They're blinded by themselves. So that's, I assume, most of us. We are blinded to the extent that we still think in terms of me in the world. Because we're blinded in that way, we do all sorts of actions. We do all sorts of things. All sorts of things dominated by that particular ignorance. And the image here is of a potter making pots. So that's what we're doing. We're creating these formations. They're called samskaras. We're creating. They're not fired though, which is a good thing. Yeah, they can be modified. So, in the past, because we've been dominated by a sense of self, we've done all sorts of actions which have supported that view. Doing those actions that support that view mean that in the present. Now, the next 8 links are all in the present, through to this one. Because we've done that in the past, we start in the present with a vague sense of self, a vague sense of me. That's been produced, it's evolved, it's arisen out of the conditions of the past. It's not a permanently existing thing. I don't normally take a lot of interest in neuroscience, but just recently I heard something which I thought was really fascinating. They've been looking at the brain, and they've discovered that there's a certain part of the brain which, when activated, gives the person concerned a sense of themselves. If there's a lot of activation in that part of the brain, then there's a strong sense of self. If there's a weak activation, then the person is not so strongly sort of self-conscious. Now, I think that's really interesting, because that's a sort of scientific way of saying, well, there isn't actually a self. There's just stimulation of this part of the brain. The interesting thing is that psilocybin, which is a hallucinogenic drug, which when I, in bygone days, I used to chase around and pick up from fields, that actually has the effect of lowering the stimulation in that part of the brain and actually lowering the sense of... Perhaps I shouldn't be saying this now, because everyone's going to be rushing out trying some. But anyway, I thought that was just an interesting little scientific fact. Right. But we do. We have this sense of self. This sense of self then develops into a more complex sense of... This sense of self is delineated here by a monkey in a tree. This monkey's just going around a tree, grabbing fruit, stuffing itself with fruit. Don't know if you've ever seen film of this, but it's delightful and amusing and very, very greedy. So this is really what the self is. It's just this attempt to sort of grab hold of things. The next one, we have a boat with five people, one of whom is steering. Now that boat represents us. It represents the body, the feelings, thoughts, emotions, and consciousness, who's steering it. Yeah. So this represents the sort of fully fledged me. Because there's this seed of me, which has been created by past actions, it comes into the fully fledged me, the me who I, get up with in the morning. That's the me we're talking about. That me then thinks, oh, I'm in a world. So that's represented by the house. The house is the me, and the world is outside the house. So we've created a distinction between the me and the world. You can sometimes get this when you wake up, can't you? You can get a sense of yourself, and then, the world comes into view. This is particularly noticeable when it's not the world you think it is. Maybe you've been travelling, and you wake up somewhere you've not been before, all of a sudden the world is not the one you quite thought it was. It can be quite disturbing. Or if you've had a very strong dream, where you've been a self in a dream world, and then you come into the material world, and again, it can be quite disturbing, that contradiction. So the me gets born in the world. We've now got the full works, if you like. You've got me and the world. What do we do then? We're in contact with the world. We can never be separated from it. We're never away from the world. So we start to have contact. And that's this embracing going on here. This is me and this is the world. Or if it's, you know, if it's a lady, this is you and this is the world. So it's sort of, it's coming into contact with the world, embracing with the world, meeting up with the world, contact. That contact can be initially pleasurable, painful, or neutral. And that's what this arrow in the eye represents. It's that initial feeling that comes when one has contact with something in the world. Now, it's a very interesting exercise to watch oneself and watch one's feelings as you go through the day. Is this something, do I like this? Do I not like it? Or do I not care? And I've done this over periods, and it's surprising how rich your life becomes, how much you realise that there's a lot of things that you thought you didn't care about that you really don't like, or that you really do like. So it sort of adds a kind of spice to one's existence, knowing what your feelings are. In dependence upon those feelings, though, there's a reaction of craving or aversion. You either want it or you want to get away from it. That's the bottom line. Of course, we're more subtle than that, but that really is what's going on, as it were, in your guts. You either want to get closer or you want to get away. Now, in this particular case, it's represented by a man being offered a drink, a seated man being offered a drink by a woman. And this is a fairly kind of explicit little drawing here. So this is the craving, this is the grasping. This man wants his thirst satisfied by this lady. Yeah. But this is what we're doing all the time. It might just be even, you know, listening to a piece of classical music, for example. You know, you want some sort of satisfaction from it. So there's a desire for it. This craving, in dependence upon the craving, the reaching out after something, there's grasping. There's actually getting hold of it. It's quite interesting to compare this, which is a woman picking fruit in a tree, with the monkey, directly opposite. So here we have, as it were, the very beginnings of self-consciousness, of grasping. And over here we have it fully fledged. We have it coming into its full being, is the actually grabbing of what it is that we're after. That grabbing then leads to becoming, which is rather graphically drawn here. In other words, once we've got it, we're there. We've done it again. And we've completed the process. So you can look at it in terms of the self. You can think, okay, beginning's a bit of a self. A complex self arises. Out of that dependence upon that complex sense of self arising is the experience of the self in the world. In dependence upon that experience of a self in the world, there's contact with the world. In dependence upon contact with the world, there's some sort of feeling. In dependence upon that feeling, there's a grasping. It could be hatred, but we look on the positive side. So there's some sort of grasping. Dependence upon that grasping, a craving, sorry, there's grasping. In dependence upon grasping, there's, well, we could say getting. We've got it. We've fulfilled the process. The next two links are in the future. Because of what we've done in the present, we're setting up the conditions for the future. And in the future, there will be yet another birth of the self. It will come into being again. And it will also die. It will die in the future. Whatever it was that we think we've grasped and we got, we will lose. That will happen. So within this circle of 12, we've got two links talking about the past, eight links talking about the present, and two links talking about the future, illustrating quite clearly that there's this cycle of creating a self, living in the world in accordance with that self, which strengthens the self, which then goes on to create a world in accordance with it, which strengthens it, and so it goes on and on and on and on. And this is why it's called the wheel of life. It rolls on and on and on forever, unless we do something about it. So, this is, as I said earlier, this is one of the main reflection practices that we do, actually, in our order. So it's the sort of thing, it's an image, these 12 links. You can reflect on them again and again and again and go ever more deeply into their meaning. It may be that what I've said this evening doesn't really kind of ring a bell. It doesn't really seem to connect very deeply with one. But I think if you come back to them again and again, then you find that there's a very kind of profound truth contained within this. One actually starts to see the way in which one's self is produced and reproduced and reproduced. Now, the Buddha taught a way out of this cycle of existence. He wanted us to recognize what was going on, to understand the nature between our actions and the sense of self that it creates and the world that that creates. But he also wanted to show a way out of it. So nirvana is the liberation from this sense of self. It's not a place, obviously. It's a liberation from that consciousness which is dominated by a self existing in a world. It's a new level of consciousness. It's a higher level of consciousness than the human consciousness. It's a Buddha consciousness. It's a new order of conditionality. And it's the next stage of evolution. So not only are we the heirs, if you like, of this remarkable 13.6 billion year evolution, but we are also, like most heirs, we're responsible to pass, to develop what we've already got. We're responsible to develop our consciousness beyond that which we inherited. This new level is difficult to explain, impossible to explain, because it's, you know, try to explain to a tree what it's like, you know, to see a cow. It's impossible. You can't do it. But it's said to have a taste. It's said to just have a certain sort of quality to it that is recognisable. And that we sometimes get this taste. A taste. Sometimes it's described even as a perfume, even more delicate than a taste. But the taste that the Buddha says, it tastes of freedom. It has the taste of freedom. His Dharma, his higher state of evolution, has a taste of freedom. So that's how we can recognize it. It's got that particular taste. This is the subject for next week. This is what I'm going to talk about next week. I'm going to talk about the levels of conditionality that give rise to ever-increasing flavour of this freedom. So we're going to be looking at the stages of development of spiritual freedom, of liberation from this self-dominated consciousness. But in the meanwhile, I just want to point out the door, where we get out of here. Many of you know, of course, where it is. It's just here. This is the door between these three links. The thing is, that up to this point, up to contact with the world, there's nothing we can do about it. We've got our sense of self. We've got our psychophysical organism. We've got our world. And we've got the contact with it. We can't do anything about that. We can't actually do anything about the way we feel about it either, because that's all been conditioned in the past too. We could alter that feeling in the future by changing what we do in the present. But we can't alter the present, we've got the feeling we've got in the present, because it's happened because of things we've done in the past. I think that's quite an important insight. That itself is worth reflecting on. So this feeling, Vedana, is the kind of the working point. What we can do when we feel something is we can go with the self, we can do what the self asks us to do. In other words, develop craving or aversion, go on round the wheel. Or we can just stick with it. We can just experience the feeling and not let the self pick it up as a reinforcing process. And that really is what's at the core of mindfulness. It's what's at the core of a lot of our ethical practices. It's the core of the development of metta-bhavana. And all of those practices, all of those practices associated with Buddhism, this is what they're really trying to do. They're trying to get us to stick here, to stop the wheel at this point, to just experience the feeling without allowing the self to push us forward. And next week, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about what happens when we actually do that. What kind of experiences, what series of conditions arise in dependence upon feeling at that point. So, hope to see you next week.